and welcome to this week's podcast with me, Jo Thiruchalvam. Protecting your organisation from claims of indirect discrimination can be difficult, especially when they stem from a policy or practice that's been in place for years. With me to discuss the steps that you can take to reduce the risk of putting in place an indirectly discriminatory policy or practice, as well as deciding whether you're justified in doing so, is Senior Employment Law Editor Bar Huberman. So Bar, first off, can you explain the difference between direct and indirect discrimination? Because what we're talking about today is mainly relevant to indirect discrimination, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Well, direct discrimination occurs when someone is treated less favourably because of a protected characteristic. And indirect discrimination can be more difficult to detect. It's where the employer applies a provision criterion or practice, which is often called a PCP, to everyone. But it puts, or would put, people who share the worker's protected characteristic at a particular disadvantage when compared with people who don't share that protected characteristic. The PCP also has to put the worker at the disadvantage, or would put the worker at the disadvantage.
Now, there are 9 protected characteristics under the Equality Act. We used to refer to these as grounds. Can you just remind us what they are?
Yes, so they're sex, marriage and civil partnership, pregnancy and maternity, sexual orientation, gender reassignment, disability, age, religion or belief, and race.
And can you give us an example of indirect discrimination to put the legal definition into some context?
Of course. So let's say a train company has a shift policy in place that requires all train drivers to work night shifts. The policy is potentially indirectly discriminatory on the ground of sex, because more women than men have the main responsibility for childcare, so they're less likely to be able to work at night.
So working our way through the definition, in your example, the policy applies to all train drivers and it potentially disadvantages women. And to constitute discrimination, the employee complaining would also have to be disadvantaged. But employees don't have to get their checkbooks out at this particular point because they still might be able to justify any potential indirect discrimination by availing themselves of this justification defence. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, so indirect discrimination can be justified if it's a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. So I'm going to explain what that means a little bit later.
And it's probably worth flagging up at this point that justification doesn't apply to all of the protected characteristics that you listed earlier, does it?
No, it doesn't apply to indirect pregnancy and maternity discrimination. It's also worth noting that you can't justify direct discrimination, except for direct age discrimination. In addition, it is possible to justify the separate claim of discrimination arising from a disability.
So if we explore this concept of justification in a bit more detail, let's say your HR team is planning to introduce a new provision criterion or practice, a new policy. What should you do to avoid indirect discrimination?
Okay, let's take the example of a new dress code as your PCP. You need to conduct a risk assessment to identify whether there's going to be an adverse impact on protected groups. So you need to ask, will it affect people because of a protected characteristic? Are there significant differences between groups of people in the way the policy will have an impact on them?
And what are the sort of things that can help you to decide and decipher if a particular group will be disadvantaged?
Well, there are a number of things that can help. So, for example, it might be worth looking back at how dress codes have been received in the past in the organisation. Were there any issues with adverse impact on particular groups of people? You could conduct research on dress codes that have been introduced by other employers. How were they received by the workforce? And you could also consult with representatives from protected groups about how it might affect them.
Okay, so staying with that example, can you give us some instances of how a dress code might put people with a particular protected characteristic at a disadvantage?
Well, one example is a dress code that requires female employees to wear a skirt. So this could be disadvantageous to women of particular faiths who are required by their religion to cover their legs. Another example is a dress code that requires men to keep their hair short, which could be disadvantageous to men if women are allowed to wear their hair long. Such a requirement could also be discriminatory on the ground of religion. For example, male Hindus may wear a small knot at the back of their head, and Rastafarians could also be disadvantaged by this.
So what happens if, when you're conducting the risk assessment, you do unearth a proposed provision criterion or practice which puts people from particular groups at a disadvantage? Where do you go from there?
Well, you should have a look at whether you can make any modifications to the dress code. Is there any flexibility which will still allow you to meet the requirements of the organisation?
Okay, so first thing that you do is to look at modifications. Assuming there aren't any modifications that really work, what do you do then?
Well, you might be able to justify the discrimination if it's a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. So start by looking at the purpose of the PCP. You need to be really clear about what you want to achieve with it, and you should really define it in some detail.
So that's a really, really key point that you've made just there. So you must have the legitimate aim at the policy planning stage, and you shouldn't be seeking to construct it after the policy's been put in place and, for example, you've received a claim from an employee alleging discrimination.
That's right. You've really got to consider it at the beginning.
Can you give us some further guidance on this requirement to have a legitimate aim?
Well, the Equality and Human Rights Commission Employment Statutory Code of Practice says that to be legitimate, the purpose of the PCP should be legal. It shouldn't be discriminatory and it must represent a real objective consideration.
And what would be an example of a legitimate aim then?
Well, we've seen in case law, common legitimate aims that employers put forward are health and safety reasons and also operational reasons. So you should ask yourself, what evidence do you have to support the assertion that the aim is justified? It isn't enough for you to generalise or say that the PCP is needed as a matter of convenience. And it can be a really good idea to ask yourself if you would be comfortable explaining the aim to a group of people.
Okay, so that deals with the first part of the justification test, identifying and establishing that you have a legitimate aim. What about deciding if the provision criterion or practice is a proportionate way of achieving that aim? Can you tell us a little bit more about how an employer does that?
There shouldn't be another non-discriminatory way of achieving the objective, although it doesn't have to be the only way to achieve it. It's basically a balancing exercise between the employer's need to impose the PCP and its discriminatory effect. So going back to the dress code example, you should look at whether you can relax the requirement or provide alternatives while maintaining required standards. So for example, providing a snood to cover facial hair could enable a man who wears a beard for religious reasons to perform a job preparing food.
And I suppose employers may well need to liaise and negotiate with third parties here, for example, the company that supplies and produces uniforms, and that would be part of this process, wouldn't it?
Yes, you should ask your uniform provider if they can adapt the uniform to meet religious requirements, and often it can be a really minor adaptation to the uniform. I know that firefighter uniforms include the option of the hijab and the turban, and those sorts of options are available for firefighters.
So even if you have an existing contract with a provider, don't assume that you can't negotiate a variation to that.
Absolutely, and if you have to, then shop around.
Can you give us some examples then of justification that have been successful?
Yes, there's a body of case law on justification. So let's take the example of operational reasons that's quite often put forward by employers. In one case, the employer was justified in requiring staff to work on Sundays as part of a rota, and the PCP was held not to indirectly discriminate against the claimant who was a practicing Christian. Here, the employer could show that it had no viable and practical alternative but to require the claimant to work on Sundays in accordance with her contract of employment.
That's a really interesting example. You also mentioned health and safety earlier as another possible legitimate aim.
Yes, in a case brought by an applicant for employment as a nursery nurse, the claimant wore an unusually long jilbab which covered her shoes and touched the floor. The employer had a policy that clothing shouldn't present a trip hazard, which it applied to all staff of all religions. The tribunal held that there was no particular disadvantage to the claimant, but that even if there was, the discrimination would be justified as a proportionate means of achieving the legitimate aim of protecting the health and safety of staff and children. So that's just one example from case law. We've also seen lots of cases that brought into play the issue of cost, and it's likely that cost alone won't justify the imposition of a discriminatory provision criteria in our practice, but it could be one of the factors taken into account in the balancing exercise.
And can you give us some other practical tips around conducting a risk assessment? Because that seemed from what you're saying to be the crucial first step.
Well, it can be really useful to have a team of people conduct the risk assessment because this is going to give you a range of experiences to feed into the assessment. And you should also include someone who's experienced in equality because they should be able to feed into the process what the likely impact of a PCP on groups of people will be. Also, remember it's important to conduct the risk assessment as you're developing your PCP. Doing it at the end when you've already decided on the PCP is unlikely to allow you to consider everything properly. Also bear in mind that you should risk assess once the policy has actually been implemented to see how it's working in practice.
So how important is that then to repeat the risk assessment?
Well, it's really important because your workforce is going to evolve. So you really need to test for discriminatory impact on a regular basis.
So you might have new employees joining who are of new religions, you might have certain elements that are more ageing, etc.
Yes, so discriminatory impact can actually lay dormant for years. Another time you should check for discriminatory impact is if you are, say, opening a new office or factory in another geographical location. The makeup of the workforce in the new location could be different to the workforce currently working in accordance with the PCP. So there might be people who are impacted negatively by it.
Thanks very much, Bar.
Thanks, Jaya.
That concludes our brief look at indirect discrimination and justification, but you can find lots of other resources on this topic on the site, including detailed legal guidance on indirect discrimination and justification, which is in the Equality and Human Rights chapter of the Employment Law Manual, which deals with each of the protected characteristics separately, and detailed good practice guidance in the Equality and Diversity section of the Good Practice Manual. That brings us to the end of this week's podcast, which you've been listening to with me, Jayathira Chalvam. We're back next Friday, but until then, it's goodbye from us.